Welcome back to the Everything is a Primary Source podcast, Part 2 Palooza, where we go back to the second half of Season 2 and listen to the second half of episodes. If you'd like to hear Part 1 of today's Part 2 Palooza, which is Suburban Rebels, which is published on March 30th, 2023, please go to your nearest podcast provider and you'll find it there. Late this winter, Rob Vader took time away from his Dungeons & Dragons podcast, We Met in a Tavern, to speak with me about the role-playing game and how it can inform us about the time period in which it entered American pop culture. This episode aired just as the most recent Dungeons & Dragons movie was released, and it turns out that the movie was just as Rob predicts in this episode of the Everything is a Primary Source podcast.
The American suburbs is probably the environment most known for people caring about what the neighbors think. By not participating in structured, adult-supervised activities like organized sports or after-school clubs, D&D players were already going against the grain and rebelling, even if passively, against the authority figures in their lives. The 1980s in America is a time marked by a deliberate attempt to return to the values and morals of the period immediately following the Second World War. The conservative revolution was well underway as Dungeons & Dragons was growing in subculture popularity in that decade. It is a bit odd how a game that promotes the same individualism and teamwork that was praised in the Reagan years would cause so much distress in middle America.
Well, I guess the skills that it develops is demonstrated right away, that if actors and writers are playing it, I can't imagine a better way to stimulate creativity than playing a game where, like you said, the dungeon master and the guides kind of lead you to a certain point. But from that point on, people, it's improv. I mean, that's what I liked about it the one time I played, is that we could, you know, take it where we wanted. And it's usually played, you know, without sounding creepy, behind closed doors. It's not something that is played in a park. You know, it's not like guys playing chess in, you know, Washington Square Park and then a Dungeons and Dragons table. It's usually like in a living room or a dining room or a dorm room or a basement somewhere, because you correct me if I'm wrong, you kind of need that insulated feel to it, that it makes it that much more, because if you had like people flying kites next to you, and you know, not only would it be, you know, potentially distracting, but you wouldn't be able to get so intense about the game and the story, right? It would just be kind of like, oh, this obviously is not real, this is, you know, there's somebody playing baseball right there.
Immersion is huge. It's very important. I like to describe myself as an audiovisual DM a lot, where like I mess with the lights and I mess with the music that's playing, and I try to make sure that like when I'm dungeon mastering, like everyone's really into the feeling. But there's lighter versions of D&D at this point. I mean, Adventures League is it's basically like you can show up whenever you want, come and play. There's like kind of a little bit more of a stringent system to it. Most game stores run it, which is like, it's a really cool way to, you can do it at conventions. And that way you can kind of jump in, you can play in a little bit more of a casual setting in the same way that you would be playing like any other board game at a game store or convention. But yeah, it does lend itself to those more private spaces, and whether it's a holdover because it used to be like hiding from people to play this game, and now we just do it in those places because it feels comfortable, or if it's just, it needs to be there because, you know, getting your, getting the immersion rate is right better in a smaller spot. It's a little hard to tell, but I think it's a little bit of both.
Now, when it comes to, so the question always comes up with this about, and this is something, so I always make it clear that I was not the one who invented these questions about primary sources, but I have added to this list a little bit because I think that geography oftentimes has some significance when it comes to something being made. And so with this one, the question is, where was it made? And or what locations are associated with it? I think we already did the second part as far as saying, generally speaking, where people have played it and all around the world and the kind of, you know, suburban setting and stuff. But where did the company and, you know, the creators of it emanate from? Are they, you know, can, is it Wisconsin, like Midwestern, right?
No, and that's, I was just triple checking. Yeah. So Lake Geneva, Wisconsin is at least where he ended up dying. But I do believe that's also where it started, was out in Wisconsin. But yeah, that Midwest kind of area is where Gary Gygax and his partner started the game. And then they started their own company, which would eventually be bought by Wizards of the Coast down the line from there. But definitely, I mean, suburbs in areas where there wasn't much else outside of that suburb, honestly.
Well, I gotta also think that there may have been some kind of, we were talking before we hit record about, you know, your own, you know, German ancestry, and, you know, I'm, Scandinavian and German, my ancestry, and that section of the country is, that's like all there is. It's like all Germanic and, you know, Scandinavian folk, you know, basically Northern Europe is pretty well represented, Wisconsin and Michigan and Minnesota. And I got to think that that probably factors into why you get the setting of the game that you do, where there's, you know, it's fantastic versions of it, but it has that medieval Europe feel to it, because that's like the, that's the exciting, one of the exciting components about European history is knights and, you know, basically the basis of so many fairy tales and even the basis of storytelling, you know, just like the fables and things like that. Like, you know, I always think about, well, I mean, there's, you know, Grendel with, Beowulf, which is, you know, Danish, fable. And that's right in the same ballpark as, you know, Dungeons and Dragons. And you have, you know, Shakespeare, the bard, you know, in a tavern, you can kind of picture that. So I feel like it all kind of rolls into one. So while it is, yeah, USA, which some, I don't know if you've ever been to a Renaissance fair, it's kind of weird. Sometimes you're like, wait, the Renaissance, like 1500s here, like nothing of this was going on here. And like, I went to a Renaissance fair in Sterling, New York, which is, you know, central New York, you know, on the shores of Lake Ontario. I'm like, if this was Elizabethan times, where we are right now, there's like Native Americans would be living here, and it wouldn't look anything like this village that you created. But it's like that escapism that we were just saying about. Yep. So do you think I'm off the deep end on that? Do you think that there's any kind of reason why, you know, is it just kind of like, could this game have come out the same way if it was made in Southern California or, you know, Virginia or something, or does it have that ancestral heritage component to it that may have steered it in the direction of medieval-esque type stuff?
So I think base D, like where D&D started, where the game was started, actually has a lot to do with what you're talking. I do think it has Germanic. I also think it has Slavic roots. Yeah, in general, communities, narrative storytelling has kind of always been a thing. That's how we pass down fables and tales before. But I mean, even in the early stories of Dungeons and Dragons and some of the things that came out of that, like Baba Yaga is like a huge thing that's involved in the games. Like, they brought straight up fable lore and they put it in the game. Like, it was, mm-hmm. it was part of it. She's a very influential hag slash witch in the games who has multiple forms, and she comes up a lot. And but yeah, I mean, that's straight from Slavic and then Germanic storytelling. She's got a lot of cross myth, which is fun. But I think it was very, I do think it was very important, especially for the initial settings, like Greyhawk, etc., like where we're talking about like medieval wars and like, you know, the shiny paladin type knights. It's actually one of the most interesting things now, because the game, it's taken a long time, but the game is finally trying to leave that that route a bit and actually start trying to create stories and narratives that have a lot more to do with like just other cultures, other storytelling.
Okay. Devices.
But for a very long time, it's very much it's right. rooted in medieval. Like step European storytelling.
Right. So it's, in, you know, as we're talking about this, it's like, it's almost like, I think, you know, D&D is like the original high fantasy type thing. But as you're saying before, that's actually more Tolkien. That's like, you know, that he was the one, and that's rooted so heavily in World War II. Mm-hmm. You know, like the Lord of the Rings is basically just World War II, you know, being retold in, you know, with high fantasy type stuff. And then, you know, but Dungeons and Dragons made it so that everybody could be creating in it. And then that is, you're wearing a Gryffindor shirt right now. So it's like Harry Potter really owes a lot of its, you know, like the acceptance of high fantasy and pop culture and in mainstream society, you know, Harry Potter pretty much is given credit for that, you know, because it was giving kids books to read initially and then movies to watch and games to play that had similar kinds of situations as what we're talking about with Dungeons and Dragons. And I would be totally surprised if, what's her name? Oh God, her name escapes me right now. The author,
J.K. Rowling.
Yeah. J.K. Rowling. That if she had, like, she's like, what's this Dungeons and Dragons? I've never heard of it. Like, I'm pretty sure she probably had some companion, you know, some relationship with the game. And now you go, and it's like Harry Potter creates a interest in it. And then as those fans mature up, they watch Game of Thrones, and Game of Thrones is high fantasy with like X-rated type, you know, components to it. And now the movie's coming out again, and then Stranger Things fits in there too. I think they get a lot of credit for, you know, shining a light on it as well, you know, because basically so many of the characters and the settings of it rely on Dungeons and Dragons as a storytelling component. So with this new movie coming out, it's almost like another chapter, but at the end, it's almost like it's at the end of this huge factory process that began all the way back after World War II. And now we're getting this, like, so I guess I'm worried in a strange way that this new movie will just kind of look like it's going to fit into the minutia of, you know, the Game of Thrones and Harry Potter and all this other high fantasy stuff, that it's just going to, that outsiders are just going to be like, yeah, it's just another one of those dragon things. You know, they're not going to take it seriously. What would you say is the, does it run that risk of just being kind of gobbled up by all the other high fantasy titles?
So I think this is, I love this question primarily because I had this exact discussion before, before we jumped on, with my father, and my dad was like, oh, I heard there's a Dungeons and Dragons movie coming out. Are you excited? And I was like, I am. And here are the reasons why. But the thing is I think they have to do it right. And which is a tall order, for any franchise. And I always feel bad being like that, 'cause I don't like to be the negative guy. I like to just go in and be excited for whatever right. content I'm seeing, whether it was Game of Thrones and how people felt about the last season, et cetera. but what Game of Thrones needs, or what Dungeons and Dragons, the movie, needs to do to be good is to not just be your run-of-the-mill high fantasy action movie. Like, we have Lord of the Rings, we have Game of Thrones, we have, like, there are plenty of those, of that content. They need to make sure that this is Dungeons and Dragons, which means it needs to be a little chaotic. The story needs to go in weird places. It needs to be a little bit funny, but it also needs to know when to take a beat and be serious. One of the things that makes the game so great is you can go, I'll temper myself because I can get candid. You can go from making fart jokes to suddenly like having your best friend rolling death saves, and like the night gets real serious real quick because this character you've played, you know, 20 games with is potentially no more. And I feel like if the movie starts playing off of those kinds of beats, the ability to have the story get a little ridiculous, not as formulaic, obviously as a DM, you try to make it like beginning, middle, and end, but there is a bit more chaos to that because you're allowing your players to help tell the story. So sometimes things just end and a new story begins. I think if they play with those I know Deadpool kind of overdid it for a lot of people, but I think there needs to be at least one fourth wall break somewhere. Mm-hmm. We need someone's character to die and then come back and get played by the same actor. I would love to see something to that degree. Or just to begin or end, do like a end slate on people playing at a table. And it doesn't need to be kids. It doesn't necessarily need to be adults, but just some kind of like,
yeah,
this is where that story is coming from. I think that'll be like almost like a never ending story.
I've been thinking never ending story the whole time we've been talking, in fact, because that's, you know, very similar. And when you just said that about, I was thinking about the Lego movie, mm-hmm. The way they did that with that, where it's like, you're getting into it, and it's doing all the right things of like talking to Lego fans, and you know, as far as like the jokes that you make while you're playing Legos, and then you learn at the very end of it, oh, this has been a kid playing with his, you know, set the whole time. And I like that idea. I'm hoping, you know, for the sake of the fans of D&D, because that way, I think one of the things that I remember being kind of concerned about when Harry Potter, when they announced that was going to be a movie, you know, and of course they're going to make it in a movie. There was no way that they weren't going to make the biggest book, you know, but I was like, so one of the things that made it so great was that kids were reading again. They hadn't read so voraciously in a long time. They were picking up books and reading it, and they were so excited for the new ones. And I'm like, but once you make a movie, every kid's imagination is now set for them. They can't, you know, they might have their own idea of what Professor Snape looked like. And then now, well, it is now, this is Professor Snape. He is, you know, and Alan Rickman, like there's no other way to see him otherwise. And it's almost like you get worried about that kind of thing in a story like Dungeons and Dragons, which is so reliant on the individual bringing their own interest to it and their own storytelling to it, that it runs that danger if they don't do what you just suggested of really turning people off and being like, that's not how I see it when I play, you know, that's not my version of it. Like, you know, that kind of, they could potentially run into some problems with that. But I think given who's in charge of the movie, I wouldn't be surprised, because John Francis Daley is a very funny guy. Like, I've heard, I know of his work beyond Freaks and Geeks, and he is definitely, I think, it's in good hands. Just like there's a new Ninja Turtles movie coming out.
Oh!
And that's another Freaks and Geeks alum is attached to that. Seth Rogen, I think, is producer or director or something like that. And, I mean, that's hyper local for us. But do we need one of these movies? And with Ninja Turtles, I don't know. I think we've had a lot of them, especially origin stories of the Ninja Turtles. We've gotten that, like, over the last 30 years a lot. You know, but if you do take on this title that's been done before, what new are you going to bring to the table? So I think that with the Dungeons and Dragons, you know, early 2000s is a rough time for movies. So, you know, as far as that, like action, heavy CGI, not very good CGI type stuff. Yep. So hopefully now that's 2023, we've moved away from that. Like you said, it has its own audience. It's we don't have the blockbuster as much as we used to anymore. So ideally, hopefully we'll have to come back and see. Maybe we'll do another podcast afterwards and do a reflection on the movie when we see it.
Yeah, no, and hopefully it's something more positive and not us just like digging into why it was right. So bad. But no, I mean, in the same sense with the Ninja Turtles and doing the origin story, I think what both Dungeons and Dragons and then Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles needs to focus on is kind of what the new Spider-Man did. Like, we don't need to know that Uncle Ben dies again. We know.
Right.
We know that's like where his, like, we know he becomes Spider-Man. Yeah. Let's just get to the story. Let's get to the new thing. And with Dungeons and Dragons, like, there is lore that exists.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it's very table to table. Like, we don't need you to tell us this deep backstory on all the lore on like how X demon exists. We don't need that. We just need you to tell us why this story is interesting and have a good time with it.
Right. I was going to follow that up by saying, yeah, because like, are there consistent characters? Are there people that are in everybody's game, or is it?
Yeah, I think the biggest ones that you notice is like there are two core rule books you definitively need. The third one is very very highly recommended, if not mandatory, and it's the Monster Manual. And that's like, that's where you're going to get the stat blocks for the majority of the things that you're going to come up against. More often than not, there are a couple like really high name ones. Actually Stranger Things is really good at bringing those ones out. Vecna is one of them. Ancient Lich, very important. I wouldn't be surprised if Vecna pops up, at least mentioned. But I think the smaller monsters are actually kind of the bigger ones. So like we've already seen it in the trailer, but we have a Mimic, which is essentially, they can technically be any piece of furniture or any item, but they're secretly like a giant maw of teeth that just wants to eat you is the best way to describe it. There was a gelatinous cube, which you see very quickly, but it's probably one of the older monsters that's existed throughout like all of D&D. And again, when you're playing a game on like inch squares, a gelatinous cube, something that can perfectly fit on those squares makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
But that's a creature that digests you from the inside when you're in there. And it's gross. It's horrifying, but it's super cool. I think getting that lore right and those monsters right will be important, but I don't think anyone's expecting necessarily the big bad to have to be a big bad that they've seen in their game or they've heard of in their game, because more often than not, where the story goes, who ends up being the big bad is whoever your DM and you have kind of determined is bad. Like a lot of the games that I've run, I like Game of Thrones, so we get into like the political discourse. So it's usually somebody high up in government who was trying to do the right thing, but eventually just made too many bad decisions. And like that becomes the big bad. And that's so I don't think they necessarily have to do Vecna or, I can't remember the mother of dragons now, but an ancient dragon. Like, I don't think we necessarily have to get that far into it for it to be a good movie. We don't need the reoccurring characters. The only thing that they should be reoccurring is the classes should be there. So we've already seen we have like a bard and a barbarian. Those should be there. And then a couple recognizable monsters will be fun.
I'm glad that I'm hoping for the best as well, because I know that the temptation has been there for a while to give origin stories and to invite the fans that viewers that may not know anything about it to give some backstory to them and to give some exposition. But I think you're right. We're at a point now with movie making that's like, we know who our audience is. We don't need to do that. And you know, I was just watching. So my son is really into Pokemon, and we watched Detective Pikachu the other night, and I loved it. I thought it was great. For that reason, because they just immerse you in a world where Pokemon exist, and they just kind of interact with people, and it's like live action, but they don't make a big deal out of it. It's not like, you know, the story where, you know, the first Pokemon is discovered, and it's like, no, they just throw you into this world, and he was disappointed that some of his favorite Pokemon weren't in it, but there was plenty of them. It was just kind of like they showed him even just for a second. In different scenes, and I was like, okay, so now we've kind of like crossed over that hump of, because like the original Spider-Man movie with Tobey Maguire, I was so excited for that when it came out, because I love Spider-Man. I thought I was looking forward to it, and my initial excitement for it stayed with me long enough that my first like three or four screenings of the movie, I loved it. But then after a while, I'm like, oh my god, like, when I look at it, I'm like, this whole movie, half of it is explaining a story that most everybody here knows. Like, we don't need to know why Peter Parker, you know, got it. And so like, that's why, you know, and I go back to the original Ninja Turtles movie from 1990. And like, they spend maybe 2 minutes in that whole movie explaining where the turtles come from. They launch you right into the story right away, 'cause they know that most of the audience is there because they know the story.
Yeah, you didn't buy a ticket to the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and not know what you were going.
Right. What is? Yeah, I don't understand. Like, and so it's almost like, and speaking of my speaking of Pokemon, and you know that Pokemon, especially the card game, comes directly from Magic the Gathering, and with those ones, and I assume the same is kind of true for Dungeons and Dragons, you know, because like I collected baseball cards when I was in like I was about 8, 9 on through, you know, teenagers. And what I always found interesting about those is that on the back it had all their statistics for what they had accomplished, what they had already done. And it would be weird because they're real people to have like on the front side, like strength, like Ken Griffey Jr., like, you know, really good at hitting and, you know, good outfielder. So they have all of their accomplishments in the back. But what I like about, you know, Pokemon and Magic the Gathering and Dungeons and Dragons has this as well, is where it's like, here's the potential on the front. Right. Here's what they can do. What's their abilities? What's their skills? You know, what's their strength? What's all this? So that when they go into the situation, we can kind of play around with it a little bit. And I think that that's a kind of behavior that is really attractive, like you said before, to the creative person, somebody who's like, okay, here's what I'm working with. What can I do with it? So, is that something that you embrace and you would imagine other D&D players embrace as well, is that it's like, it's trusting me to work with what I have in front of me and make the best out of it?
Yeah, I think so. More as a DM, honestly, but also as a player, I could see it. So like, as a player, you can determine your stats when you start the game in many different ways, but the traditional way is rolling for your stats. But like, and you would have the same, the same way that a monster card would have like strength of this, etc. And you, that's a realm, you figure that out for your character. And I think we all, a lot of people get into it because they like improv, they like playing in a space and telling a story, but some of the best storytelling comes from having some parameters, like having something to work within. So I do think that's 90% of the benefit of having those stats in front of you. And then as a DM, when I'm like, okay, they're in a cave, it's definitely full of spiders. So I need the spider card so I can figure out what a giant spider can do and blah, blah, blah. But other than that, I just need that card for reference. I need that card for like quick thinking on like, okay, it's this far away, what can I do? But otherwise, it can just tell the story versus me not having any of that to work with and just being like, okay, they're going to be in a spider cave tonight. And then me have to like make all that up by myself. Like my improv is going to drop significantly. Right. I'm going to spend a lot of time figuring out the mechanics. Having a couple reference pieces for mechanics suddenly makes the storytelling so much more dynamic. And I think that goes again for playing your character as well. When I know that one of the characters I used to play has high charisma, I'm like, all right, that means he's going to try to talk his way through things a lot. He's going to try to like flaunt himself. He's going to use that characteristic to do most things. Mm-hmm. And again, it just kind of informs the improv, informs the role play. So I think great tools.
Yeah. Now, before I loop this all back around and bring it around to, you know, our closing, I just want to say that, as you know, from my perspective, when I call everything's a primary source, by describing all those things that you do, all the games that you play, understand that for my brain, I'm like, oh my God, there's another primary source. Like the reason why he goes in, you know, high political with his, you know, storytelling is because of what's going on in real life and, you know, or the kinds of, you know, movies and TV series out there that are influencing the game in real time. So I'll have to stop myself there. I got to show restraint. but what it, my question is, you mentioned early on that a major component to the success and the popularity of D&D has always been like that escapism feel to it. But do you think that there's anything about it that it's like, I mean, the game is not escapism, like, you know, Second Life or something where it's like, I'm making this one up, like flying in the clouds escapism. It's called Dungeons and Dragons. It's called something very scary and very dark and dank. So is there almost like a component to it that you feel that players have immersed themselves in it, yes, to escape from the negativity of real life, but then once they play for a while, they enjoy rejoining because then they're like, oh, by comparison, this law and order society I live in is actually pretty nice compared to the chaos of and danger of Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah, I think there's a catharsis to it. I think that's kind of what it, one of the things that it comes down to, in the same way as like it's easy to sit down at a table, play Dungeons and Dragons, and do some crazy things like scale a mountain, fight a dragon, things that we would not do in our day to day. Come back, have a new perspective, and then move on. But at the same time, all I did that night was I had a slice of pizza, I had a couple of beers, and I didn't actually do anything that defying, but I felt like I did, and I got all the catharsis I needed. As someone who has, in the last few years, jumped out of a plane for the first time, I got a lot of catharsis out of that, but that was actually dangerous.
Right, right.
There is something nice about being able to put yourself out of your comfort zone while maintaining being in your comfort zone. And I think that's kind of what drags people in.
So it's almost like a roller coaster effect in a way, you know. But exactly. So would you say that has Dungeons & Dragons contributed, and you can only speak for yourself, but maybe other people have reported, you know, like you said, like maybe building up confidence, building up, you know, that feeling of like, okay, if I can accomplish great things within the game, maybe that's giving me the boost to do something in real life that's like jumping out of an airplane or scaling a wall, or, you know, is doing something a little bit dangerous in confidence wise.
Yeah. Not to get on a soapbox either. I think it's a great way to learn skills, to gain confidence, to practice. A couple of the big places that I've seen D&D starting to be used for that actually specifically are both with children with learning disabilities, and as well as like youth who are questioning their sexuality, etc. There's been a lot of psychological studies going in there, and being able to like give people the freedom to play in those spaces to express themselves. Kids with autism or like social disabilities, they're using that to like teach them how to interact with each other and play. And it's like, it's easier in a play space than it is in a real space, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's great. I think it's, it has definitely given me confidence. It's given me new skills. DMing has also helped, I think, with my career, like learning how to run meetings and how to keep people on task and stuff that I was good at. But like, this is a place where I've had a lot of practice now. I think it's a brilliant tool for all those things.
So that makes the 1980s, you know, even if it is done in 2020s TV shows, I'm speaking of Stranger Things, the 1980s kind of, you know, suspicions of Dungeons and Dragons kind of, it puts it to rest, because it's like the benefits far outweigh any perceived costs of somebody getting way too involved in, you know, because I guess ultimately the best thing about Dungeons and Dragons is that there's no screens involved. It's not, you're not isolated. It's, you really can't play alone, right? I mean, it's something you need to have other people around to do. And so I think that we can smash that to bits and maybe go back in time and tell them it's okay. These kids are, they're going to be fine. Like, they're actually maybe more equipped than other kids, you know, that are just playing Nintendo all the time to get through. So, Rob, I can't thank you enough. I'm glad we got to work this out. It's too bad we didn't meet in a tavern, but that would have been, you know, even nicer. But thank you for taking the time to talk about Dungeons & Dragons. Where can people find you and your show and everything else on the internet?
Of course. We met in a tavern. That is our handle on pretty much everything. So Instagram, Spotify. We're on just about anywhere you can find podcasts. So Google, Apple Podcasts, Facebook. We met in a tavern, and we've got 7 episodes out, and we're jumping into season 2 this year. I'm just finishing up my my draft and my outline, and hopefully we have some more fun interviews coming up. But
awesome.
Yeah. No, and thank you for having me. And honestly, I owe you a beer next time we're both at Ludicrous.
Hopefully I won't be too long. With this weather, will just stop. I can actually, you know, get down there okay. But hopefully it won't be too long. And thanks again for everybody listening. And this is the EPS podcast, where everything, including Dungeons & Dragons, is a primary source. We'll talk to you next time.
There are only a few more installments of part 2s from season 2. The Everything is a Primary Source podcast before the start of season 3. Be sure to follow the show on Instagram at @the_EPS_podcast, and be sure to visit everything-history.com on the web. Tune in next week for the continuation of the EPS podcast Part 2 Palooza, where everything is a primary source.